The whole system of education in your public schools of learning is based upon error, so how can the coming generation be right when the first privileges they absorbed in school were almost all wrong? What a monstrous unkindness this is, and what a serious mistake those who have the power to change it all have made. The law of love and all branches of natural study should be taught and applied in your schools right along with the common branches of general school routine. But instead of this, the child's brain is cramped at an early age with all means of stuff and pure rubbish which he never will be able to use in his short span of years on the material side, nor either in the spirit realms. And thus all the laws of love, charity and kindness are forgotten or crowded aside, for there is no time for so much reality on the earth side. What the mortals seem to desire for their young is simply the show and fine glitter of perishable things, and which are flaunted with great pride today, but tomorrow are cast aside for the great spiritual awakening, when God calls his own. Oh, how many souls go into darkness because those with whom they lived on earth could not be kind enough to show them ere the hand of death snatched them from earth, the better and the true way. Oh, the biting cold that will creep into a heart when the real milk of human kindness leaks out. We are making a great struggle and a real battle against the unkindness existing on your side of life. Kindness is the living element in man, which is the building power of all his better nature, and when refined and cultivated, is the perfect grace of the spirit. Be kind in little things. Attune your voices each day of your lives to speak in the soft cadence that only kindness knows. You will soon find that this practice will bring you many friends, much happiness and love abounding. Be kind for the very love of it, and not because you believe it to be a conventional fashion. Be merciful and kind to those who walk lowlier paths than yours, for really you never know when all that you possess financially may be swept away, and you might suddenly find yourselves where your brothers are. But if you possess the rich heritage which only the soul development can bestow, and if you fan that blessed flame of the life of the inner self, then have no fear, for no man can steal it or take it away. Dear ones, the first lesson of soul unfoldment is centered in the four tiny words and their execution: be kind to others. How many beautiful things have come to mortals through their simply being kind. And you never know when you execute a kind act to a suffering sister or brother, what returns may come in after years. And if you surely do these things, with the faith born of love, and expect no recompense, then shall your cup of joy be full indeed. Oh, how many, many millions of earth's people have suffered for want of this sweet thing, kindness, when there was no need of this suffering, and only the selfishness of the fellow man, breathing and living the life of wrong and error. Kindness is long-suffering and of patience. It is humble and eternally forgiving. It is the last link which must be found before earth's multitudes will join together in one everlasting brotherhood. Friendship, George Sand. The brightest jewel set in the crown of true man and womanhood is the bright and precious gem that causes its wearer to possess a heart of pure gold, feelings ever tender toward all the world, and a nature ever unswerving and faithful to a friend, a jewel that works wonders for its wearer and owner, and its name is friendship. Of all the qualities possessed by mankind, friendship is one of the greatest. The strong iron band that being beaten and welded together, through the toils, privations, joys and sorrows of years, and wielding in its completion that magic seance, which stands always open between friend and friend, is really one of the entrances ways to paradise. The bells of heaven ring in glad peals of pure joy when the angels witness the loyal truth of two souls vibrating in the chain of sweet friendship. The real and underlying meaning of all true and real friendship does not consist of the mere conventionalities of society, meeting and exchanging friendly and social greetings, and then in the greater matters and concerns of business, to be able to forget in an hour all of this so-called warmth and friendship and turn their nature into the hard and calculating channels of life. Real friendship does not exist in such natures as this, for mortals of this class have all their conscious lives driven that all-purifying element out of their souls, and have never left one jot of room for it to re-enter. As for the matter of that, you of the earth who may go out in search of true friendship and seek your wide world over, and come home laden with a sparse few of its gleaming gems, but when it is found there in its heart, it is the Elysium of the desert, the teeming pure waters of reality in love, and the oasis is in a great barren place of rocks and stones where no green thing abounds. Spirits weep as they stand on these glory shores and gaze down into the depths of these barren places of earth, but when one of these pure running streams is made visible to their view, they take hope, and organizing new hands, send them to earth for the sole purpose of drawing mankind into a closer bond of friendship, into a deeper and nobler brotherhood with one another. How we have striven and are still striving to reach this accomplishment with earth's people, and thanks to the eternal principle, at last mankind in general will understand, and hand clasps will not be any longer careless, and hurried smiles will not spread over faces with the idea only of mere sociability, for this whole system is threadbare and reeking with slime and filth, but men will meet each other as only those possessed of real faith in each other can meet, with a smile beaming out of the eyes from the heart of the soul, and hand clasped in hand closely shall betoken the bond of the real, the only, the true friendship, and hearts listening shall hear and understand. Oh, blessed time! In the commonplace social phraseology, the name of friend is often chorused from lip to lip, with meaningless sentiment, for more than two-thirds of the people who use this phrase so glibly do not know the first principle of what it means. The name of friend should only be given to those who deserve it. To men and women who face strong dangers and self-sacrifices for the benefit of some fellow human to whom they are bound by the strong bond of friendly devotion. The man or the woman to whom those in dire distress may call at the mid-hour of night, and hurrying out of a warm and comfortable home will come and succor those who are helpless and cast upon the troubled waters. To these brave relievers of distress, to these truly heroic souls should be wisely given the name of friend. To what seeming extremes the law of friendship has led thousands in the past. Some men would sacrifice anything, whatever, life for a friend, and like Pythias of old, would gladly stand in the place of Damon whilst he should go home and tell his wife and child goodbye, for the very last time upon earth. And when Damon was delayed, and yet at last galloping in to meet his death, how Pythias stood clad in the strong armor of love and self-control, sacrificing the cries and beseechings of his sweetheart, stood in the place of Damon even with his head on the block, waiting the headsman, when Damon came panting into sight, and with fast fading strength, and mighty love threw himself into the outstretched arms of Pythias, when they stood in that wondering throng and mingled their tears together. For this the magistrate pardoned Damon, and the two men like two sweethearts went hand in hand out of that place of awful death and were once more strong in each other's affection. Thank God, there are yet some Damons and Pythias left yet, and more will be born into the world, for friendship shall be held more sacred in the coming years than ever before. The so-called dead, Moses Hell. The world, in which you of the earth live, is the experiment station of the after years of your spiritual abode. It is that plane of life in which you serve your apprenticeship, and thereby carve out for yourselves something of attainment finally. The earth is your abiding place for the present, and a little short while in the future, and while you are living on earth, is the time to make good your covenant with the immortal life that is awaiting each and every one of you. What are you doing with your lives? Walking through your material existence, meeting your troubles and sorrows, reckoning continually on how many more dollars you may be able to get in today, over yesterday, meeting the death of your loved ones with a few tears of selfish grief, and after their body has been encased in the earth, you go out into the world again and form new ties of affection, and all that remains of the old loves, is a vague bitterness at the mention of names or at the sight of their old photographs. They who pass out of your physical vision grow to be no more to you than an old and tender memory, for all that you can feel is the material life and all its environments. This is the man who does not know of the other life and all its beautiful certainties. The man who cannot see or feel that his loved ones really are as natural and have their being in our world as life itself indeed is blind. And not having this knowledge, he who can only see with the material vision, for their lives are made up of earthly aims and desires, for anything past the border is to them shadowy and quite unreal. But when some beloved one that has been as a very light unto their footsteps, that has so grown into their lives as to become a part of them, and they cannot realize life without that blessed one's accompanying presence. And in the heyday of that blissful time, comes in that dismal visitor, death. All unwelcomed, all unsought, he comes, and when he departs, he bears with him the precious life and love of some fond but undisciplined heart. And then to the sufferer that is left behind in that home that both of them had once called heaven, alas! He has plenty of time now to ponder and wonder in his mad grief, if there be another life. So strange in all his life that the thought of dying had never troubled him before. This terrible thought to him now grew to vast proportions, and all the light of his paradise had suddenly been turned out, and he was left in the blackness of an awful night. For he had not thought that she could die, she who was so rosy, so strong with love's sweet strength, so happy and so very young. Strong men have lost their reason in times like these. Oh, the pity of it! But why is all this? It is simple. Their spiritual eyes have never been opened. Once they were, and all the rest of peace would have followed. For when death comes and visits one of earth who realizes the other country, who knows with an everlasting knowledge that our world is as natural as yours, and that the varying difference is that our abiding places are not made with hands, and therefore cannot fade away, and that we lay up treasures where moths cannot creep in, or where the rust of years cannot demolish them. One who walks the earth and possesses this knowledge, is the richest man in the world. Why, think how easy it is to sacrifice for the ones you love, how happy you have been to give them up when they were starting on an earthly journey, where you knew they would find environments to their happy advantage. Why, you would give them up gladly, willingly, although your heart might be sore at the final parting, but then would come the sweet thought that they were not gone forever, but that in the morning of other years that they would come again, and that then you should be all the happier for the glorious success they had wrought. No soul wishes to part with loved ones on earth, even just for a little while, unless he really knows where they are going, and when they pass to our side of life, and there is no preventing it, then, oh, then is the time of sorrow. But the spiritualist knows that his so-called dead are not dead, but that they have just completed a journey to a happier clime where their mission in life will continue on through all eternity. Knows that although his loved ones are gone out of the physical body, that they are not lost to him, but have risen into the higher existence of the soul. Ah, and you who know can see them over here in the eternal summerland, walking in the sunshine of youth and life forever. Look into it and see what you are doing with your lives. See if you are finding out where you are going at the close and fall of the curtain of your mundane existence, and when you hold within your hand the real key to life, spiritualism, unlock the great doors of eternity with it, and make for yourself and those you love, an everlasting dwelling of peace in the heavens. Right Living, Emanuel Swedenborg. What a man eats makes up the greater part of his physical body, and as the body is the covering for the soul and is in its association so closely allied as to be for the time that it exists, almost the soul's other part, we should therefore be very careful what we eat. The soul must have a physical part through which to express itself, and the body is that part. Therefore, if the body is coarsened and made rude by feeding with barbarous diet, truly the soul must take on a part of that very coarseness in finding its expression through such an instrument. Another very important thought, and a very practical one, is that whatever habits you form over on the earth side, you must keep up over here until time and progression have wrought a change. For friends, in truth you must, and always do, take up the thread of life just where you left off when you laid aside the old dress for the new. There is no jumping straight up into glory as soon as you are done with material life, no. Natural law says that all of us must and will follow along the course of progressive nature, and that if you have a certain set of foods, for instance, that have quenched your physical appetite, and of which your very soul has dwelt as a part of you, then when you find yourselves in a state of life where none of the old foods are to be had, where there is no taking of life, no killing or murdering to eat of flesh of animals, then, oh then, what will some of you do? You will want this old menu. And for what reason? Because you have never known any other method of sustaining life, and you have become so used to eating the flesh of animals that it has become a part of you, What will you do then when you find yourself very suddenly an inhabitant of a country where there is nothing to eat but fruits and nuts? Will you not suffer the pangs of hunger so deeply that you will at last go back to the earth plane and absorb some of the essence of the old foods as the mortals take the substance? Think of the low, groveling condition of those bound to earth in such a manner. To be compelled to be present with those who are continually groaning with hunger for the flesh of animals, and even to partake of it yourself because you have lived on it all of your lives on earth. You will indeed cry out at the result of your own misery and of your ignorance and foolish error. How many men and women of your land ever give this subject a thought? Why, there are intelligent and finely educated brains on earth today who claim to be very spiritual, and still they are continually stuffing their bodies with flesh and grease of various animals. To believe that more nutriment is to be gotten out of meats and grease thereof, is a foolish error. They only sustain an appetite that is perverted, and a mind that is beset with unwise and terrible conclusions. You, who eat cooked flesh, are but little better than the savages, for they eat the same as you, only they prefer it raw. It is very true that many mortals who at present live upon the earth plane, do not know any better than to live their lives precisely as they are living them, but within a few years of ignorance will no longer constitute any excuse, as the law of progression is being handed down so universally into the material world that the friends of earth can no longer avoid the truth, and then if its precious demands are not obeyed, great will be the waywardness thereof, and much and deep the suffering, after entering the spirit world. As we look out over your great world, to you as yet only a suggestion to us, we often grieve at the waywardness of the earth children, that we are so constantly placing within their daily environment and within easy reach the true and only law of life itself, and yet we see them stray wildly out of tune with nature, and thereby lose all the harmony and building melody of the spiritual and material universe. The great pity of all of this, it will never be riches that will place you in a plane of existence where you will be able to live absolutely right, ah, no. For money is the eeriest dross, and only made to command the world's prowess, but if you have spiritual wealth, and keep storing away treasures in large quantities in real spirituality, you will be gaining surely and swiftly that place in the realms of pure delight, even while you are yet sojourning on earth, and will at last come to an almost perfect understanding of the true value of right living in all its glorious qualities. Many believe that they are living rightly if they are constantly helping others, and so in the main they are. And those who help others thereby sacrificing their own interests, are to be much merited therefore, and this trait alone has helped many a poor mortal through heaven's gates and shown him eternal peace in the great summer land, although he might have been himself spiritually ignorant in general. But the brother who can in teaching and helping others, absorb the great lesson of the spirit himself, and by this wonderful aid send out around him as he walks the earth, that mellow radiance which so many marvel at, and so few possess, he is indeed great. Most precious is the soul of man, indeed, so valuable that it has been given eternal life from the eternal Spirit of God, and kept secure always from the rust and weather of ages, kept sweet and fresh as the fountain of youth herself. If you will only help the eternal plan a little each day by making yourselves cleaner and braver men and women by the process of pure and right living, not only by the thoughts you nourish in your souls, which are your offsprings, but by the very foods which you are putting into your stomachs from day to day. Some of the world's greatest philosophers so lived within the security of the laws of soul life, that they never turned their attention to foods for the body save to go into the forest each day and gather the roots of sweet herbs, and with a pot of gruel eat heartily thereof. Their souls were indeed large, growing continually, and so can you do if you but knew and really would. My blessing and the blessing of this band go with you. My experience, Fulvia and Sylvia. I have asked permission to come and give a part of my experience, and the professors and doctors of the wonderful star circle have granted my wish, for they tell me they believe this little reminiscence will be of benefit to those who read it. I had been a great sufferer both in mind and body for many years when gradually I felt my physical pain daily and weekly lessening until at last I grew almost to be without uneasiness at all. My husband, who was a wealthy and prominent merchant of New York City, had been sending me to all parts of the earth to see if I could not regain my lost health. I felt all the while as if something very dreadful was going to happen to me, and this thought was so constantly with me that it grew into vastness and overwhelmed me, and I grew afraid of the faces of my mother, my husband, and my darling little girl baby of 3.5 years. A long period of time elapsed, I know, for I was unconscious so very long that they told me afterward of incidents that had happened long since, but of which I knew nothing of. It was at this awakening that I found all the old terrible numbing pains gone, and in their stead a quiet, restful calm, but withal an overwhelming weakness. The awful mental strain had partially passed away, and I seemed to have no cares, no tribulation now, only to rest and think of the future which seemed to hold so much of promise. It seemed all the while as if I was detained in a place where I dwelt against my own wishes, and once I asked another lady who came there to visit some one of her friends, what place it was that I lived in, and she quickly replied, "Why, my dear, this is a perfectly lovely place where those who are sick come to get well. Those whose minds are sick, and they are made whole again." "Sick minds?" I questioned. "What are sick minds?" She was very kind and answered, "Why, dear, minds that have too heavy a burden laid upon them suddenly become unbalanced. In other words, minds who lose their sanity and become insane." "Insane? I'm not insane, so why am I here?" I asked. "See, I have just begun to know who I am, for I have just awakened. I, madame, am an East Indian princess, and am held here in this vile place in captivity, through a wicked conspiracy. When I can have access to my people, I will show the ones who are in power here, that I am far more powerful than they. I will have my liberty or—" But I did not finish speaking, for she ran from me out into the hallway and down a long corridor out of sight. I cannot recall much of that scene, only that I felt a calling for my people, my train of servants, to come to my aid and help to release me. But no one seemed to hear me, for no one came to my rescue, and so I just shrieked myself almost hoarse. I must have fallen prostrate, for I found as I awakened that two women were raising me. They appeared to be nurses, for they wore white caps and aprons. I was in bed after that a long, long, weary while, and each day seemed to bring new and changeable delusions. But I was an East Indian princess, that I was sure of, for now my people had come to me in my magnificent sleeping apartment, for I could see my servants with their bands of white and yellow draped upon their heads as they went to and fro, doing my bidding. But there was something very strange, very mysterious about them. Whenever the white-capped and aproned nurses of the house came to wait upon me, I could see them through my own servants' bodies, for my own train were as transparent as a thin piece of cloth. This I deeply pondered over until all of them frowned, so at time I stopped and lost myself in the beauty of a lot of water lilies that suddenly sprung up in a large basin of water that was sitting on the table by my bed. They seemed to grow and unfold as I watched them, and I was so enraptured at their beautiful faces that I fell asleep and dreamed I walked amid them in another country where all was sunny peace forever. I was suddenly awakened by a great din in the streets. I knew instantly that they were coming to destroy me, possibly they who had detained me in this terrible place. I began screaming and calling, trying in vain to make my servants come to my aid, but when they heard me, they only laughed, and I was helpless. All the passages were locked and bolted, I found on trying them, and so I just beat upon the walls and doors for release. But no release came, and soon I was utterly exhausted and lay prone upon the floor moaning and crying. Suddenly I heard a strange but sweet voice calling me, and opening my eyes I saw a beautiful woman in gleaming white robes, bending over me and pleading with me to come with her. She was not like anyone else that I had ever seen. She was so frail, so sweet, so strangely beautiful. I raised myself and started to go with her, but almost before I knew it she had vanished before my eyes. This worried me so that I was never at rest about it. I saw her often in my dreams, but coming to the conclusion that it was one of those white-capped nurses disguised and trying to play a trick on me, I grew to hate her, and she came no more, but in her stead came another, radiantly beautiful, but dark and strong-looking, and as she walked it was like the crawling of a snake, so willowy and supple was she. She had a head crowned with hair as black as midnight, and it fell around her like some deep storm cloud. She told me so many nice things that I forgot all the noise that I had heard in the streets, and oftentimes when she laughed her black eyes would glitter like beads. But one day as we walked together through the grounds with one of the house nurses, my beautiful companion told me that she had not been telling me the truth and that she had thought I would surely see it after a while. I was amazed and questioning her. I saw an awful evil light creep into her face, and she smiled as I looked at her, smiled her terrible smile right into my soul and maddened me. I kept gazing into her face, I could not turn away, for her dark eyes full of their strange fire held me. But she sank from my sight just as the other one had done, and when I next remembered I was in my own room in bed, and I was very ill. The nurse told me I had been unconscious, but not dangerous. I could not see anyone in the room but the house nurse, and this worried me greatly. Had they forsaken me, my servants whom I had deemed so faithful? They had a thousand commingled emotions wrought on my sensibilities. But the nurse told me I was better and hoped I might see my husband soon. My husband, she spoke of my husband, as if I had a husband. All that I felt conscious of at this time was that I had been very ill, was very ill, and that because I had suddenly grown more restful and quiet, the nurse thought I was almost well. How little after all do those who are trained for a lifetime know of sickness and death. But I lay quite ill at ease, nothing seemed to be quite right. Until after a few hours my faithful servants came back to me, and passed like pale specters between the nurse and myself. She did not know they were there even, they walked so gently and spoke in such low tones. If she had been conscious of their presence she would have driven them away. But we fooled and deceived her nicely. Why not? Was she not deceiving me? When I made demands she heeded them not, neither looked at nor answered me. Oh, the cruelty of it! I told her often enough indeed that I wished to go to my native home in India, and adjust matters there, for there were most assuredly some commissions there that I had left unfulfilled, for I had been snatched most suddenly and cruelly away. I felt sure she thought my undone tasks amounted to naught whatever, for she was always silent when I spoke of them, except that sometimes she would say, in a dreary monotone, "Rest now and sleep, and when you are stronger you shall go home and do what you will." Rest until I grew stronger, the very idea. I got to thinking of her words until they began to burn me like fire, and just to show her, one day how strong I was, I flew from my bed and grasping her by the shoulders I threw her instantly backwards and down under my feet, all the while proclaiming my strength. Two other house nurses came running in, and some men in blue suits with burnished buttons took her away from me, and if you'll believe it, locked me again alone in my apartment. I was so helpless in the awful misery of my detainment that I sank down and prayed for help. Soon I lapsed into a strange state of apathy, and then I felt perfectly at rest. I was not able to move any member of my body or even exercise my vocal organs to speak, yet I felt now all suddenly different, and withal, very much better than I had for years. All things began to be clear to me now, and it was now no trouble for me to recognize my own identity perfectly. And I remembered having felt that I was the Indian princess, and that now that same strange feeling was only a vain delusion. I could see no more the pale and horrid specters of the past. I had been insane. I knew now that I could look back on my pitiful condition. Now, just now, if I could but speak or move. If I could but prove the restoration of my normal senses, how much it would mean to me. But alas, I could not. It was the useless body now in place of the scattered brain. Oh, but I did make such a valiant effort to tell and prove what I now so suddenly had become, but it seemed of no use, as I could not even so much as flutter an eyelid. As I lay all resigned to my position, waiting to be released with full strength, one of the old house nurses who had attended me so faithfully, came in at this hour to see how I did. She did not stay long, however, but rushed back with a body of others and a young physician. "You see for yourself, doctor," she said, sadly, "she is dead. I told you as much." A great dreadful chill of intense agony crept over me. I was no more dead than she, but merely hopelessly helpless. And there they tarried and at last decided that I was dead. Like one that is dead I lay, like a white corpse indeed awaiting burial. I saw and heard all the preparation for my burial, saw my dear husband and baby girl come and stand by my cold winding sheet. So many thousands of miles he had traveled to be at my funeral. He almost grieved his heart away because I had died before I had regained my reason. Oh, Lord of hosts, how fervently I did pray then to be given the strength and use of my body until I could tell them that I lived and that I was soundly restored to sanity.